The headlines. Iran says the end of war heralds a new era in the economic rejuvenation of Syria after a decade of turmoil. Finally, an admission from the Saudi coalition that a video alleging to show a Yemi arms depot was fake. And a tragic ending for a Palestinian man, 80 years old, as Israeli forces beat him up in handcuffs. Hello and welcome, everybody. It's our top story for this half hour. Iran's Minister of Roads and Urban Development, Rostam Qasemi, says the end of the war in Syria is the beginning of a new era of economic relations between the two countries. Qasemi is heading an economic and political delegation on a three-day visit to Syria. He will meet with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and other top officials. The Iranian minister has said his talks with the Syrian officials will cover various fields, including industry and construction. Upon his arrival in Damascus, Qasemi was welcomed by the Syrian economy and trade minister. Mohammad Samer al-Khanil said his country seeks extensive cooperation with Tehran. Iran has been a major contributor to Syria's reconstruction efforts in recent years as the country struggles to emerge from the ruins of the war that devastated its economic infrastructure. Well, for more on that story, we're now joined by writer and journalist Mimi Alam, joining us from Perth. Ms. Alam, welcome to the program. It seems that, it appears that the war in Syria is now being moved to a new front. Damascus has for a while been saying that the U.S. is seeking new ways of imposing its dominance over the country, especially by using instruments, economic instruments, that is, and with the help from NGOs in the region. Given that, how do you analyze the visit of an Iranian economic delegation to Syria at this point in time, and how significant do you think that is?
Well, one of the most important points I'd like to get across is even though they've stated that this is about economic, after the end of the war, this is about more economic ties with Iran, the war has not ended yet. The U.S. is still occupying the northeast of the country where most of Syria's oil and wheat is. And it's also the case that Turkey and the terrorist groups are occupying the northwest of the country, Idlib province. So it's still an ongoing war. The problem is that Syria cannot get to the next phase where it can regain all its territory because the U.S. is crippling its economy. And Iran is a very important partner in attempting to regenerate Syria's economy, and that's going to take reconstruction as well. I think that without Iran's help economically, Syria is not going to be able to regain control of all its territory and face off the biggest threat in the region, which is the Zionist state of Israel.
Do you see, Ms. Lam, a cohesion between having a stable Syria, economically at least, and a more stable region? Do you think that economic cooperation between Iran and Syria could also increase stability in the broader region as well?
Well, I think that the situation right now, if it stabilizes at this point, that wouldn't be very good, because the situation right now isn't good. I mean, Syria's economy is bad, it's occupied, it's basically a balkanized country unofficially. And so if stability means that the status quo is held, then that wouldn't be a good thing. What would be good, however, if stability means that Syria will become stronger and able to face off these terrorist threats and occupation in its territory, in the long term, then that would mean stability in the region.
All right, thanks a lot, writer and journalist Mimi Alam, joining us from Perth. Elsewhere, the Saudi-led coalition fighting in Yemen admits that a video it released over the weekend about an arms depot there was fake. Spokesperson Turki al-Maliki says the video was passed in the wrong way by one of the coalition sources. He called it a marginal mistake, but Yemen's National Salvation Government described it as the greatest sin committed against the Yemeni people with the support of the U.S. The Saudi-led coalition released the footage on Saturday, saying it makes Yemen's Hodeidah port a legitimate target. The Yemeni army was quick to react. It said the video was taken from an American documentary film about Iraq and has nothing to do with Yemen. In recent weeks, Riyadh and its allies have stepped up their campaign against Yemen. Well, we've talked to Barry Grossman. He's an international lawyer. He believes fake evidence is the same type of justification that the U.S. used to press its case for war on Iraq. And its allies are now sticking to the same technique to justify an unjustifiable war.
Well, I guess my question would be is why we don't see more of this. To be clear, this is a 9/11 era tactic. It's been used repeatedly. It was used in the buildup to and justification of the war on Iraq. It's something we see Israel time and time again in beating the war drums against Iran. It's standard operating procedure for the U.S.-led Atlantic world and its allies in the region. That is, they release knowingly what are misrepresented or even fake images. The damage is done in the sense that the public has swallowed it lock, stock, and barrel. That is, the political will to do what they set out to do has been manufactured. And then somewhere down the path, without a lot of media coverage, they admit that it was a mistake when it doesn't matter anymore. There's, of course, no accountability. And this is yet another example of that. Clearly, as you pointed out in the introductory piece, claim, this video was released by Saudi Arabia to maintain the embargo and to make these ports a legitimate target in an illegitimate war.
A new day, a new aggression from Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. They've detained an elderly Palestinian man, restrained him with handcuffs and assaulted him, resulting in a tragic outcome. Our correspondent Tin Ramalamona Kandil has been following the story and has this update for us.
Palestinian old man, 18-year-old Omar Abdel Majid Assad, from the village of Jaljiliya, northern Ramallah, was found in an area close to his home. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, Israeli forces were in the area. They arrested him. They handcuffed him and beaten him as well and left him in that area. Then he was found by Palestinians and immediately transferred to hospital. However, he arrived to the hospital after his death. The Israeli military issued a statement. They say they are investigating the issue. They don't know what happened. This is according to them. But we have to mention that every night, Israeli forces raid Palestinian areas, villages, cities, and refugee camps to arrest Palestinians. Many people were wounded and killed during these arrest operations, even if they were not wanted for the Israeli security forces.
On the 10th anniversary of the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan, Tehran condemns the move as a gross violation of human rights. During our news review program, we discuss the issue with our guests. Let's take a listen.
Iran says the assassination of its scientists is a gross violation of human rights and that the perpetrators will not go unpunished. Secretary General of Iran's Human Rights Office, Kazem Gharibabadi, made the remarks in a tweet on the 10th assassination anniversary of Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan, a nuclear scientist. He was killed by a bomb attached to his car in Tehran in January of 2012. Many Iranian nuclear scientists have been attacked and assassinated since 2007, with Mohsen Fakhrizadeh being the latest victim who was killed in 2020. Tehran and Western intelligence agencies have long been putting the blame for the targeted killings on Israel. Now joining us for the program is Mr. Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer from London, Ontario, and Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start with you, Mr. Edward Corrigan. Hope you're safe and doing well, Edward. Good to have you with us again. Your thoughts on these multiple targeted killings of the top nuclear scientists in Iran?
Well, it's really an act of war against Iran. And, you know, it's it's really terrible because there's been no evidence whatsoever that Iran has been pursuing, you know, a nuclear weapons program. All of the reports of the International Atomic Energy Agency, of the Ayatollah Khomeini, said that nuclear weapons are wrong and issued a fatwa against them. And you have, well, at least six scientists assassinated, one other that was wounded in an attempted assassination. And the most recent assassination was on November 27th of 2021. So this is, you know, crazy. But I think the reaction of the Iranian people and the Iranian government is that these people are considered martyrs, and it actually, you know, encourages the development of a peaceful nuclear program and reinforces Iran's drive to be independent and self-sufficient in terms of power. Israel, of course, is, you know, rumored to have, you know, maybe as many as 400 nuclear weapons. They've not signed any of the nuclear disarmament treaties, or and they have, you know, at least tested a nuclear weapon with apartheid South Africa in the mid-1970s. So, you know, Israel is being hypocritical in that they want to have the only country in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons. They're, according to John Gunther Dean, who is the American ambassador to India, Israel was also behind the assassination of General Zia because he was pursuing a nuclear weapons program for Pakistan. And Israel has, you know, a recent book said that Israel has made 2,000 assassination attempts, many of which were successful, not all. And that is, you know, the behavior of a rogue state. But could you imagine what the reaction would be in the United States or Canada or probably Western Europe if Iran had assassinated six Israeli nuclear scientists and was, you know, waging this assassination campaign against Israel or the United States or any other country? There would be a huge uproar. But unfortunately, in the West, they seem to give Israel a pass that they can run around assassinating whoever they want. But this is an extrajudicial execution and is totally illegal. And I would say it's really an act of war by Israel against the Iranian people. Now, Ehud Olmert, who is a recent prime minister of Israel, just said that an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities by Israel is pure nonsense. And he said it is unnecessary arrogance that indicates weakness, not strength. I think that's a very, very appropriate statement from, you know, one of the top political leaders in Israel.
Thank you, Edward. And Robert Fantina, welcome to the program there, bud. Thanks for your patience. Now, Robert, it's funny, aside from everything that Edward mentioned about gross human rights violations and the legality of it and the irony here is that it didn't even intend to achieve its intended target. You take out six of the top nuclear scientists in the country, the nation's nuclear program is still flourishing. So what was the point?
The point was a couple of things. One, Israel wanted to show that it can do this, that it can assassinate Iranian scientists, it can go into another country, assassinate people in that country with impunity, that the international community will not demand justice, will not demand that Israel be punished in any way for this crime. Now, Israel is pushing the situation, and at some point it's going to push a little too far. And then they are going to receive consequences that they did not anticipate and that even the United States will not be able to protect them from. But Israel is a rogue state. It is not interested in international law. It's not interested in human rights. These things are clearly seen on a daily basis in its treatment of the Palestinians. So the fact that it will do anything whatsoever to maintain its status as a major powerhouse in the Middle East, including illegal assassinations, cannot be surprising. Iran only threatens Israel as another major player in the Middle East. Iran has not attacked another country in a couple of centuries. That's not the way the Iranian government works. However, the Israeli government, the current government officials, have clearly stated that they've switched from defense to offense because that's what they feel they need to do. But this is all enabled by the United States, which fosters any crimes, it finances any crimes that Israel commits. But Israel can continue, I hope it doesn't certainly, but continue to assassinate the nuclear scientists in Iran. Iran is a large, largely populated, well-educated country There are plenty of nuclear scientists there. It's a shame when one is martyred, but there will be others to take that person's place.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program with your respective input. Edward Corrigan and Robert Fantina, both out of Ontario, Canada, one from London, Ontario. That's Mr. Corrigan and Mr. Fantina from Kitchener. And that's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
Get vaccinated or pay tax. That's what Quebec province in Canada plans to do in the coming weeks to contain a surge in its COVID cases. Quebec's government says the fee is yet to be decided, but it will be significant. Non-essential stores are also closed to the adults refusing to get a COVID jab. The rules don't apply to those unable to get vaccinated because of medical reasons. Some lawmakers say the measures are a distraction that would divide the people of Quebec. The government rejects that. It says the unvaccinated account for half of COVID patients currently in intensive care units. On December 30th, Quebec announced the return of certain restrictions, including a night curfew and a ban on private gatherings to battle its virus surge led by Omicron. COVID infections hit a new high in France amid a fresh surge in cases across Europe, mainly fueled by the highly contagious Omicron variant. French officials reported nearly 370,000 new infections, the country's highest single-day caseload so far. Meanwhile, hundreds of health workers took to the streets of Paris to call for better working conditions. They demanded new hires and higher wages, among other things. In Italy, new cases more than doubled compared to the previous day to top 220,000. Italian officials also logged nearly 300 more deaths. The World Health Organization says the Omicron COVID-19 variant is becoming dominant in Europe. The WHO's regional director for Europe underlined that Omicron is highly transmissible based on new data collected in recent weeks. However, he expressed optimism that the approved vaccines still provide good protection against the new variant. The remarks come as Britain has reported a drop in daily infections, logging over 120,000 new cases. Europe on the whole, however, has been at the epicenter of the new outbreak, with many countries reporting a record number of infections. That's a wrap for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
By no means has voting blue meant a change for the better. In fact, the only real difference between Biden and Trump in terms of foreign policy is that, instead of mean tweets, more respectful language is used to give the new president the veneer of respectability, says Robert in Lakesh Journalist in an article titled, Biden's Diplomacy is Back, Falls Flat as 2021 West Asia Policy, a Miserable Flop. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. Throughout his political career, Biden, whatever may have been his personal misgivings, supported the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, voting to launch the invasions and working under the Obama administration on a policy to continue what he now calls the forever wars. In Iraq, unlike Afghanistan, 2021 did not see the U.S. withdrawal. Instead, it has pursued a policy of aggression and lawlessness, followed by an agreement with some people that will guarantee a U.S. presence in the country for the foreseeable future, a move celebrated by many of Biden's supporters. The Biden administration did announce a supposed drawdown in Iraq, which was to be done under the guise of ending the U.S. combat mission inside the country. Despite claims that the combat mission has ended and that relevant troops were withdrawn, 2,500 U.S. troops are still in Iraq and are likely there to stay. The reality is that the U.S. has never stated it had ground troops in Iraq to begin with. It claimed to use only special forces units, describing other troops as trainers and advisors to Iraq's security forces. Therefore, the connotations ascribed to the phrase ending the U.S. combat mission are incorrect, for there hasn't been a combat mission in the country for years. But what of the deadly Predator drone program, which became infamous under former President Barack Obama? Biden has, since taking office, refused to comment on the practice of so-called targeted killings and assassinations, which overwhelmingly kill civilians and not combatants. It is also difficult to tell exactly how many were killed in drone strikes this year, owing to a Trump-era ruling that scrapped the need to report drone strike deaths. Despite this, we do not know that the Biden administration has used the targeted killing program in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia. In Syria and Iraq, at least two separate airstrike campaigns were undertaken by the U.S. president without congressional approval. The U.S. is still also illegally occupying a third of Syria's territory, sitting on over 90% of the country's oil resources, as well as its most fertile agricultural lands, going so far as to send poisoned seeds for Syrians to cultivate. When the Syrian government announced that it could not use the seeds because they would potentially destroy fertile soil, the U.S. regime insisted the seeds were good and refused to apologize. In the case of airstrikes in Somalia, a dangerous escalation occurred when the U.S. terrorist military forces ordered strikes against militants without even notifying the U.S. president, a move that Biden failed to condemn. On the issue of Palestine, Biden has acted as expected. After all, he openly describes himself as a Zionist. When Palestinians were being ethnically cleansed from their homes in East Al-Quds so that illegal settlers could steal their properties and racist lynch mobs attacked Palestinians around Al-Quds Old City, Biden remained completely uncritical of the Zionist regime's policy of protecting the settlers and attacking Palestinian protesters. In May, when the violence escalated into a war between Gaza and the Zionist regime's military, during which the fake regime of Israel killed 270 Palestinians, the president repeated the age-old "Israel has the right to defend itself" line, a trope repeatedly used by Washington when Tel Aviv carries out what have become routine civilian killing sprees. The Zionist regime's current Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, is openly opposed to a two-state solution and has rebuffed American demands to halt settlement expansion. Yet Biden has yet to master a word of criticism of his Israeli counterpart. Instead of reining in its ally, the U.S. approved $1 billion of additional funding for the Zionist regime's Iron Dome air defense system to pay for what amounts to the inconvenience caused when killing Palestinians with U.S. taxpayer-funded bombs causes a reaction from the besieged Gaza Strip's armed groups. On Iran, Biden claimed he was going to differ from his predecessor Donald Trump, stating during his 2020 campaign that we've lost our standing in the region and vowing a change of tone and policy from Trump's openly hostile stance. Since he took office, though, Biden's promises to force his way back into the Obama-era Iran nuclear deal were soon forgotten. And instead, he has charged forward with Trump's maximum pressure campaign. Instead of attempting to make peace, Biden has added even more sanctions to those levied by Trump, which were previously criticized and condemned by the International Court of Justice as a violation of international law. The Biden administration's first year of diplomacy first policy in the West Asia region has closed as many veterans of U.S. elections predicted. By no means has voting blue meant a change for the better. In fact, the only real difference between Biden and Trump in terms of foreign policy is that instead of mean tweets, more respectful language is used to give the new president the veneer of respectability, while carrying on an all-too-familiar violent and imperialistic West Asia region foreign policy.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesley. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Years ago today, the first prisoners arrived at the newly built Camp X-Ray prison at the U.S. Naval Base in Cuba's Guantanamo Bay. It was supposed to be a makeshift jail and never intended to be permanent, but from day one, it had an ambiguous legal status. Outside normal U.S. law, it housed what the military called enemy combatants, not prisoners of war. More than a dozen independent U.N. rights experts voiced outrage that the military prison is still operating. They said in a statement that 20 years of practicing arbitrary detention without trial, accompanied by torture or ill treatment, is simply unacceptable for any government, particularly a government which has a stated claim to protecting human rights.
The U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba is back in the spotlight as the notorious facility marks its 20th anniversary. The facility was established under an order by then U.S. President George W. Bush as part of his so-called war on terror that he waged in the wake of the September 11 attacks in 2001. The order authorized the U.S. military to hold foreign nationals in custody without charge indefinitely and prevent them from legally challenging their detention on alleged terrorism charges. The Guantanamo was chosen because it is located in Cuba, not on U.S. soil, and prisoners held there are not eligible for habeas corpus. a fundamental right that protects against unlawful and indefinite detention. Over the past two decades, at least 780 people, the majority of them men captured by the US and its allies, have passed through the facility. Some 730 of them have been transferred elsewhere under a program known as Extraordinary Rendition, which is the transfer without legal process of a detainee to the custody of a foreign government for purposes of detention and interrogation. Nearly 40 inmates still remain there, while an unspecified number lost their lives in due course, mostly as a result of torture. The US has time and again come under fire for widespread violation of human rights, including torture such as waterboarding, sensory deprivation, stress positions, inhumane interrogation techniques, solitary confinement, secret transfers, forced feeding of hunger strikers, and enforced disappearances, and many more. The US has so far resisted calls from human rights activists and international bodies for the closure of the god-awful compound. Recently, a group of UN human rights experts have voiced outrage at the detention camp, calling it an ugly chapter of unrelenting human rights violations. They have described the facility as a site of unparalleled notoriety and a stain on Washington's stated commitment to the rule of law. They urge the US to close the site, return the detainees home or to safe third countries, and provide remedy and reparation for those tortured and held arbitrarily. US President Joe Biden, like his predecessor Barack Obama, had pledged to close the facility. But it seems to be taking a U-turn on the promise, as the facility will be expanded further with a new courtroom worth $4 million to be built later this year. The United States' actions violate its obligations under the Third Geneva Convention. The UN rights body in the past also spoke out against Washington's failure to close the facility as a clear breach of international law. As fears continue to grow over an impending human tragedy in the notorious jail, the international community must also be held accountable for its failure to take concrete actions against a country that claims to be the defender of human rights.
Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi, and these are our guests in tonight's edition of The Spotlight. Writer and anti-imperialist activist Chera Lavash in Detroit. We're also joined by co-editor of the Anti-Conquista, Nicholas Ayala, in Newark, New Jersey.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show. Now, Cheryl, former UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Execution, Agnes Callamard, has said that, I'm quoting her, that Guantanamo remains an indelible stain on U.S. history. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's much more than an indelible stain. It, in fact, is part and parcel of U.S. imperialism. As I was thinking about this interview, these comments today, I thought about how the war on terror is actually a war of terror on the world, and what we've seen since 2001 has been a devastation on every continent.
Right. And Nicholas, we also have American criminal defense lawyer Nancy Hollander saying that Guantanamo illustrates that the U.S. is a country that, quote, does not respect the rule of law. Do you share the same view?
Yes, very much.
Nicholas, please. Yeah.
I think that what Guantanamo Bay really represents since its initial founding, when it was founded, they had no intention to follow the Geneva Convention in Guantanamo Bay. It wasn't until protests, not only here within the U.S., but internationally, did they actually force them to follow some sort of Geneva Convention, which even then can still be questioned. But what Guantanamo Bay represents is a nation which is both hypocritical in its actions towards its towards non-citizens, but even towards its own citizens, and it's hypocritical in its in what it claims to be its values of law, of what it stands for in terms of protecting civilians, of so-called protecting the world. Many of the individuals in Guantanamo end up being innocent, and so when we talk about there being living contradictions, Guantanamo Bay is quite literally a living contradiction. Mm-hmm. That, as the last commentator is really much greater or much worse than just a stain on this nation's history.
All right. And Charles, we have Amnesty International speaking of multiple unlawful government conduct over the years, including secret transfers, incommunicado interrogations, force feeding of hunger strikers, tortures, enforced disappearances, and absolute lack of due process. And in spite of all this, the camp is still operational. Why is that?
Right. Well, the camp itself is not just a camp, an error, a failure of judgment, or anything like that. In fact, it is, on occupied territory. Mm-hmm. It is illegally held in Cuba. Cuba has demanded for the return of the naval base and has condemned also the prison camp and the torture and conditions. In fact, it said when the United States has said that Cuba is torturing demonstrators, which is a lie, they say the only place that torture occurs on the island of Cuba is in the occupied Guantanamo and in this prison. Mm-hmm. So that's really the point of it, that it's not an aberration. It is part and parcel of the military domination that came to a high point after the attack on the Twin Towers in 9/11. 2001. This war on the world if you look at certainly Afghanistan in the news today, many news outlets, I don't want to minimize the torture that took place and the hardship on all the people who were kept, some 800 people. There's 39 men who remain there, and the horrible conditions. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is, this is part and parcel of the United States and the United States policy. You can see it in the prisons here in the United States as well. Look at not only Afghanistan, where now there's danger of widespread famine, and even the Congressional Progressive Caucus has called for the U.S. to stop the sanctions. You look at what happened, the false war that devastated Iraq, built on lies. You look at Libya. You look at what has been done to Iran. You look at Latin America and this war, and now building up a war against China. When we look at Guantanamo, we have to call for the prison to go, call for the land to be returned to Cuba, its rightful owners, and that we also stop the kind of military expansionism that the United States is attempting to do through its war on China. These things are all interrelated.
Right. Now, Nicholas, what the United States has done in Gitmo has been abandoning the rule of law, ignoring due process, arbitrary detention, torturing, you name it. One such practice has been enough for the White House to decide and instigate chaos or plan, you know, regime change in other countries. Is this not double the standard? Is this not hypocrisy?
Right. I mean, it's complete hypocrisy. You know, the U.S. claims that other nations, they make repeated claims that Maduro and previously the former Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez were, they were torturing the opposition, that they were arresting political prisoners, you know, executing people, et cetera, all of which they, you know, they had no claims for, but they were doing themselves in their own prisons in Guantanamo Bay, you know, with their own CIA and state agents were doing so. So, mm-hmm. you know, the U.S. hypocrisy and the double standard always exists, and it always exists for those nations who are enemies of the United States who do not meet U.S. interests, right? Because you can then point to nations like Saudi Arabia or Israel who follow very same procedures when it comes to torture, having secret camps, you know, illegally arresting and detaining individuals. But these nations and their leaders never get called out. They never get criticized. They never get sanctioned or embargoed by the United States, despite the fact that they are doing these same crimes that the U.S. is claiming that other nations are doing.
Right. And, Cheryl, there are three U.S. presidents, and all the three promised that they wanted to close Guantanamo. We had President Bush, Obama, and Biden, but that hasn't happened yet. Why?
Well, it hasn't happened yet because they are always looking for excuses not to have it happen. It should be a very simple thing to do, right? When they want to do something, they can do it rather quickly. Mm-hmm. And the closing the prison is only the first step. And I would assert that the movement about the Guantanamo prison and closing the prison needs to also enlarge the demands about returning Guantanamo and getting the U.S. out of that naval base. Keeping that prison keeps the door open. You know, there have been threats about sending, they're not official threats yet, of sending people from the United States to Guantanamo. They want to keep Guantanamo. They've talked about moving people who are refugees from Haiti, as they've done before, to the Guantanamo naval base. So the whole structure there, there's the National Guard from South Dakota is being deployed to Guantanamo as part of the, you know, it's part of the military operation around the world, the 800-plus military bases that occupy and threaten the world, and the prison is just a small part of it. You know, the excuse that they don't know how to get send people here and there. Biden just released one person, and apparently Trump only released one person from Guantanamo. But also, by them dealing with the prisoners that still exist, it brings up what happens on this day every year, and that is we remember mm-hmm. what a crime it is to have this prison in existence, to have Abu Ghraib and the rendition sites around the world. Lithuania was just agreed to pay one of the detainees money for his abuse at a secret site in Lithuania. These are crimes of a country that has said it is not it's not eligible for the International Criminal Court. It refuses to sign that treaty. It is above the law, or it needs to be brought into line with international law on this case and many, many others, internally as well as externally.
Mm-hmm. Now, Nicholas, unlike Obama and Bush, who at least spoke of intending to, you know, shut down the notorious camp, President Biden is going to spend $4 million to expand the detention facility. Your take on that?
Right. I think it's important to... it's interesting that Biden, you know, usually... So far, what we've seen, he's kind of gone back a lot of his promises. This one, he hasn't really gone back on because he really he never made the promise, but you could go back to previous, you know, years ago before he was running for president, where he also expressed similar intentions as Obama. But again, you know, what we're seeing, I think what we have to ask ourselves, why does Guantanamo Bay still exist 20 years later? After we've already pulled out of Afghanistan, after the so-called war on terror, after we got the guys who did 9/11, why does it still exist? And I think part of that's part of the reason why there's still expansions to it. And the answer to that is an interesting. It's that, you know, Guantanamo Bay mostly is targeting, if we're being honest, Muslims and people from the Middle East. And it's interesting because I think back to there's a famous prisoner, revolutionary prisoner from Colombia here in the United States being held in solitary confinement. He was part of the Revolutionary Armed Forces in Colombia. And his arrest, after he was arrested, he was not sent to Guantanamo Bay despite being considered an enemy combatant and despite being a terrorist. He was instead sent to a federal prison. So then why is it that, you know, when we go to the Middle East and we engage in these wars, that we have a whole prison and a whole torture system set up against, you know, people from the Middle East, people who are mostly Muslim, and from who are all, you know, from many parts throughout the world but have been captured in our wars in the Middle East? Why is it that we have this prison in place? And I think it's because, you know, as we've said earlier, it's to terrorize the world, right? This prison exists as a almost as a symbol of U.S. power, of U.S. terror. This is what the U.S. can do to you no matter where you are located, no matter who you might be. If you consider yourself an enemy to us, this is where we can send you. And that, I think that symbol, it's a very nasty and negative symbol. And I think that's why you have people like Obama saying that they want to close down the prison. But behind the scenes, they don't really want to close down the prison because that's also a very powerful symbol. It's a scary one. It's terrifying to the people of the world.
Right. Now, Cheryl, there are many observers who argue that the Guantanamo detention camp is a product of the so-called war on terror. Do you share the same view?
Well, that's the reason that they gave for creating it. But the other guest really makes a wonderful point that now it exists as a way of terrorizing people with what will happen if you resist U.S. imperialism. Mm-hmm. Certainly, it was constructed as part of the infrastructure for the military aggression that used the 9/11 attacks as an excuse. I would say that's and the fact that it is an example of U.S. Willingness to torture and murder people from around the world without trial, without any kind of democracy or any rule of law.
Nicholas, former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney described Guantanamo prisoners as the worst of a very bad lot who are very dangerous and devoted to killing millions of Americans. And this is while some of the people kept there were terrorists created by the U.S. And you mentioned some of the Muslims kept there. Is this not the case of chickens going back home to roost?
It very much is, you know, the U.S. is getting what's, I don't want to say what it deserves, but it's getting what it's sort of cooked up. It's, you know, it creates a problem, and then the backlash from that problem, you know, is oftentimes the punishment that the U.S. then has to deal with, right? You know, we went into Afghanistan, we funded and really helped in the rise of the Mujahideen, which then became the Taliban. So we created a lot of the people who would then go on to commit the terror attacks against us. And so this is really, like you said, a creation. We created this problem, and the solution really isn't much of a solution. It's going to create further problems, right? I mean, the invasion, the occupation, invasions of the Middle East, and then the rounding up of random citizens, innocent citizens, you know, some of whom, some terrorists as well, but some people who are, a lot of people who are innocent, that's going to cause more backlash. That's going to push more people into the arms of those who already hate this country. And, you know, it makes sense that's going to push them there because you're terrorizing the people on the ground. So really, this is the U.S. kind of getting sort of dealing with its own issues, the problems that they created ourselves.
Right. Chair, we have 1 minute, and you know, there are 39 men still being held in Guantanamo. How much longer do you think they will be kept there?
Well, what everything shows is that there is no impetus to moving people out of Guantanamo. If they're building this new building that has no gallery for any visitors or people to observe the procedures, they are not making any plans anytime soon. So we need to redouble our efforts to tell the truth about Guantanamo, about Guantanamo Bay, about how the U.S. is spending twice as much as what the Build Back Better would cost. The U.S. is spending that on the military budget. It is a systemic problem, and we need to tell the truth about it.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this show. Writer and anti-imperialist activist Cheryl Labash joined me from Detroit, co-editor of the Anti-Conquista, Nicholas Ayala, from Newark, with our comments and contribution. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام ما أحسن تواضع الأغنياء للفقراء طلبا لما عند الله وأحسن منه تيه الفقراء على الأغنياء اتكالا على الله
Amir al-Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, "It is good for the rich to show humility before the poor, to seek reward from Allah, but better than that is the holiness of the poor towards the rich with trust in Allah."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us on the program. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So, dear friends, when we're talking about life, hand in hand with life, of course, comes death. Now, some of us, for some reason, and the reasons are pretty particular, we have a tendency to fear death. But in reality, death is not something to fear. Death is just another step in this whole process of life and of creation. Now, one of the things that we must always remember is that every single one of us will die, one day or the other, sooner or later. And this remembrance of death really is a cure for many illnesses of the heart and many illnesses of the soul. Now, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course, within the scope of his universal persona, has spoken about not only this concept of death, but this concept of how the world deceives us. And one of the reasons that we are deceived by the world is because we do not take into consideration this fact that every single one of us will die. So along these lines, there's this tradition where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "O you who swear at the world with your tongue, but you are attached to its vanity in your heart, say, when did the world deceive you? Were you deceived by their taking care of you and a medicine which might cure you, but with the coming of death, they were all useless?" Now, on a very interesting note, of course, we find here that Imam Ali alayhi salam again is talking about individuals who, via their tongue, they proclaim to be detached from the world, but in their hearts they are very much attached to the materialistic wealth, to the materialistic possessions of this materialistic and temporary world. Now, he's really addressing everybody, though, in this sense. And he says that, when did the world deceive you? When did the world, with its wealth and its beauty and its glamour and its excitement, deceive you and make you forget, one, that every single one of us will die, and two, that this world is not the eternal abode. This earth and this world is not where we will remain for forever. And so why would you invest so much into something that will remain here and not go with us towards the next part of our life, meaning the hereafter? And then Imam Ali, he brings up these two very interesting points. He says that, are you deceived by people taking care of you when you are sick or when you are down or when you need help? These people that come and take care of you, does that make you think that you will live here forever? Or perhaps the medicine which you take that cures you, does this deceive you that you think that there will always be some sort of medicine that will save me from the clutches of death? Or perhaps in the past, and even perhaps in the modern day, this search for the fountain of youth, the fountain of eternity, are these things deceiving you from the fact that all of these things will be useless? They won't matter when death comes knocking upon our door. And so, dear friends, why not work and invest in the hereafter? Why not work for the hereafter? Invest in the hereafter, a place where we will remain forever, whether it is a good place or a bad place. And where is it that we will accumulate the luggage and the provisions for that world? Well, it is in this world. A profound and beautiful lesson brought to us by the universe.